Everybody here has the 8.5x11 version with comb binding. This hopefully will just fit inside a typical Bible, and everybody feel free to take one of those if you don't have one already. But as I say, they are identical to the larger size, so handy if you need them. But while it's on my mind, I really hope that you're spending some time with this. It's just not possible, brethren, without having a Revelation class that would last about 3 years, I think, to really dig down into each of these symbols. There's just too much material. And so frequently you'll discover that I am not mentioning things that I did put into your notes. And it'll be most helpful. I just strongly want to encourage you to go ahead and especially be reading the verse references in other parts of the Bible that you'll find line by line in my syllabus. That especially is where it gets time consuming, is running down a half dozen different passages, you know, and some of the Old Testament prophets and whatnot. And so frequently I end each class and I just think, oh, I could have got into this, I could have got into that. I'm not sure that I spent enough time here, you know, so that you would see the strength of it. And so I'm counting on you, trusting you to put in some additional time yourself. In that opening page, you'll remember there is what would be page 3 as the numbering goes, these recommended commentaries and general books. If you could only afford or have time to read one book, I think the one I would recommend is the one I've listed as number 4 in the syllabus on that page, which is entitled The Beast of Revelation by Kenneth Gentry. These others are outstanding. I really, you know, could hope and pray that you'd have the means to get into those, both financially and time-wise. But if you had to pick only one, you know, I think that would be the one, followed awfully closely by The Avenging the Apostles and Prophets, which I listed as number 1. But particularly, of course, as we're dealing with chapter 13 last week, Beast of Revelation, there's a book that'll be most helpful for you. So that said, I particularly was frustrated last week with chapter 13 because it is such a fascinating study of the sea beast, the land or earth beast, and then, of course, the number of the sea beast. We have clearly the picture of a nation. And as a matter of fact, in most commentaries, whether you accept an early date or a late date doesn't even matter in this regard. Homer Haley, I read his commentary in preparation for chapter 12, for instance, and he understands chapter 12 essentially exactly the same way that I do. And when we come into chapter 13, again, it's essentially the same. We all see that verses 1 through 10 in chapter 13 are dealing with the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire is fitting this just to a T. And so then you have 11 through the end of the, well, actually 11 through 16, I guess, that deals with this second beast, the sea beast, that is lending his power to the first beast. So this earth beast is representative, and again, with just a little bit of a twist, virtually everybody sees it the same way. It's either false religion in general, or it's the idolatry of the Romans, or it's the false prophets of the Jews. Either way, you've got false religion lending its weight to the false political power of the day, or at least, you know, the ungodly political power of the day, in chapter 13. Later, as I said, we'll get into these heads and horns and all that you had in that first sea beast, as this is going to come up again in greater detail later. So we'll deal with that, chapter 17. But tonight, you know, just let me add this little bit with regard to the number of the beast, that 666. That is the most fascinating passage in the whole Bible, I guess, for the Protestant denominational world. They hang much of their eschatology on that passage, the last verse of chapter 13. They are tremendously hung up on this because they have this myth that the man hadn't come yet. So that clearly nobody to whom the book was given could ever calculate his name. He isn't here yet. And that, you know, is a gigantic flaw in their reasoning. But nonetheless, very, very popular to think that this is the capital A, what? Antichrist. You'll hear the term, the Antichrist. This, they think, is this guy. What's the problem with the theory of an Antichrist that has not come yet in John's other letters? Kara. Okay, now that's exactly right. She's exactly right, but I'm going for something, and it sailed over your head there, my fault. With regard to Antichrist, I mean, and that term, Jared.
According to John's first epistle, there were already not a one singular Antichrist, but many Antichrists. The term is standing for one who stands against the Christ, rather than one specific person.
See, that's exactly it. The Bible doesn't ever speak of an Antichrist as if there's only one, or even as if there would be one that would be somehow worse than the rest. In 1 John, we have this term Antichrist, which you don't even have in the book of Revelation. And in 1 John, you have many of them at the time that John is obviously then still living, is writing both of these books, Revelation and 1 John. So I just wanted to say to you, remember that as you're talking with your friends in the various Protestant denominations today. They think that this number could not have been calculated by anybody to whom the book was given 2,000 years ago. Point that out to them. These people would be able to discern who this individual was, whether you call him an Antichrist or not. In Revelation 13, 18, they are commanded to calculate the number. They can figure this out. And that's impossible if the Antichrist hasn't come yet. And secondly, you take them over to 1 John, and there's no such thing as the Antichrist anyway. There were many Antichrists. That term only has to do with anybody who is opposing Christ. They are anti-Christ. We have Antichrists today. We've had Antichrist for 2,000 years. We had Antichrist in the first century. They have made this mythical and monolithic individual out of whole cloth, as we used to say. It's just to say that just invented it. That whole concept does not exist. And this man is a man that could be calculated in the first century who is simultaneously representative of the beast, the sea beast, which is the kingdom. He has to be some kind of king. So they've come up with dozens and dozens today in the left behind theologies and that kind of stuff, to identify who this guy might be. None of them can conceivably on any level meet the simple statement that's made in verse 18, that those people 2,000 years ago could know who he was. Greg, quickly.
And that word calculate means you make mathematical calculation. When you look it up, that word comes from adding things up, like when you're voting, adding up the votes.
Exactly, and thank you. That is what you're to do with the number of his name. Employ what we now call gematria, which is their system of assigning numbers to, or numerical values, to the letters of the alphabet. So, okay, but enough on chapter 13. It is endlessly fascinating. There's so much been written on it in our age. Read the book, The Beast of Revelation, and it'll certainly fill out much of what I'm just not taking the time to deal with. Yes, Bill. If I understood what you're saying, you're asking, do the people today who think of the Antichrist think of him as being a normal human being or as supernatural somehow? Is that the question?
Speak of them that way.
Pardon me?
Does the Bible speak of them one way?
As being supernatural somehow? No way. He's a human being, whoever he is, boasting and blasphemous and with enormous power, and Satan, giving him that power and all, but it's not a supernatural power. I think, can call fire down out of heaven, for instance, in Revelation 13. does not require that it be a miraculous event or a supernatural event. Jerry?
In John's first epistle, apparently dealing with the heresy of Gnosticism, those that were advancing that that false doctrine were anti-Christ. And of course, they were human beings, not super or some sort of divine being.
And again, absolutely, and thank you for that. And the magicians of today are at least, and only as popular as they were back then, and so these kinds of faking miracles and wonders and signs is an old thing that you can read about in ancient history, right, down to faking ways that it appears fire comes down out of the sky and that sort of thing. So, all that said, then, reluctantly, we leave chapter 13 behind, though it does come back again in the form of that sea beast later in our studies. Let's take on now chapter 14, and as is my habit, I don't really want to read all 20 verses before we get any farther along. And these verses, which really should be taken in concert with chapter 13 as well, chapter 13 and 14 flowing together belonging together. As you'll discover next week, if I do things the way I normally do, I'll take both chapter 15, which only has 8 verses, and chapter 16 together next week. But in both cases, I think it's wise to think of 13 and 14 as kind of a couplet, and then 15 and 16 the same way. They really go together. So now in 14, verse 1, "And I looked, and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his name and the name of his Father written on their foreheads. And I heard a voice from heaven, like the sound of many waters, and like the sound of loud thunder. And the voice which I heard was like that of harpists playing on their harps. They sang a new song before the throne." That's where we get that term, new song, that song we sing so much. "They sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders, and no one could learn the song except the 144,000 who had been purchased from the earth. These are the ones who have not been defiled with women, for they have kept themselves pure." And you may have a footnote, literally it says, they are virgins. "These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever he goes. These have been purchased from among men as first fruits to God and to the Lamb. And no lie was found in their mouth. They are blameless. And I saw another angel flying in mid-heaven, having an eternal gospel to preach to those who live on the earth, and to every nation and tribe and tongue and people. And he said with a loud voice, 'Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. And worship him who made the heaven and the earth and sea and springs of waters.' And another angel, a second one, followed saying, 'Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, she who has made all the nations drink of the wine of the passion of her fornication.' And another angel, a third one, followed them, saying with a loud voice, 'If anyone worships the beast and his image, and receives a mark on his forehead or upon his hand,'" see how closely this is all lining up with chapter 13, "'he also will drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is mixed in full strength in the cup of his anger. And he will be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. They have no rest day and night, those who worship the beast and his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name. Here is the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. And I heard a voice from heaven saying, Write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow with them. And I looked, and behold, a white cloud. And sitting on the cloud was one like a son of man, having a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel came out of the temple, crying out with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, "Put in your sickle and reap, because the hour to reap has come, because the harvest of the earth is ripe." And he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was reaped. And another angel came out of the temple which is in heaven, and he also had a sharp sickle. And another angel, the one who has power over fire, came out from the altar. And he called with a loud voice to him who had the sharp sickle, saying, "Put in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, because her grapes are ripe." And the angel swung his sickle to the earth and gathered the clusters from the vine of the earth and threw them into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood came out from the winepress up to the horses' bridles for a distance of 200 miles. That's a lot of blood. All right. Then, chapter 15, I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels who had seven plagues. There is a kind of a natural break there as we get a group of seven angels with plagues now at the start of chapter 15. So, what have we got? Well, we've got, especially as you'll see in verses 9 and 11 of chapter 14, still a problem with this beast in his image. We've got people that are being fooled. We've got people who maybe even willingly are choosing to serve and to worship this beast which Satan is controlling or backing and is given all his authority to. It's Satan at the top, the beast that he's running immediately under him, and the beast, the earth beast, is also later referred to as the false prophet that is giving support to this empire, the Roman Empire. And we have people then who are forced to make a choice. Will you worship the beast? Will you worship the image of the beast? Will you forsake God and choose then to give yourself to the service of the empire somehow? Which, brethren, again, I think most people understand, references the first century presence of the Roman Empire, and especially in Israel, where the first fruits, those that are the early Christians, were in a bind. While there would be no official Roman persecution initiated by any emperor until Nero in 64, there would be 34 years of Christianity before Rome would decide to step in and persecute Christians per se. But Rome has been persecuting the Jews and hating them, fighting with them. They have been, and the first fruits, of course, are all Jews, so that the Christians are caught in a jam. The early Christians are Jews, and Rome has a beef with Jews. And then the Roman Empire doesn't start persecuting Christians as distinct from Jews until 64, but the Jews did persecute the Christians from day one. So they're caught in a vice. First century Christianity, brethren, was no fun. First century Christianity was a major test. First century Christianity was to lose your possessions, your family, your friends, your life, your country, be driven into exile. It was harsh. The Jews were on them to begin with and were using the Romans, forcing the Romans, you know, to have a hand in it, but only reluctantly until 64. And then you got Nero stepping up to come against the Christians as Christians individually. Either way, you know, it's tough going. So these early saints were familiar with the pinch of salt that had to be offered and burnt on a censer as a worship or at least allegiance to the emperor and to the empire. As I say, most people, I think reasonable Revelation students at least, you know, see that as a high probability candidate for what's taking place in chapter 13 and 14 with all this talk about worshiping the image of the beast. Christians had a problem with Rome. They couldn't practice the idolatry, and with the Jews, who were their initial and major persecutors from the beginning. So I looked and behold, verse 1, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion. Now, if you look at my notes, with regard to the Lamb, every occurrence of a Lamb in Revelation, which is 26 times, it's Jesus. And even then, I put the except 13:11. You can look at 13:11, and that's really no exception either, because it's not even a Lamb. It's horns like a Lamb. Okay, but it's not a lamb. And so it's the beast. It's earth beast, second beast, coming up out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb. But every reference to a lamb, except for horns like a lamb in that case, it's Jesus. So Jesus is standing on Mount Zion in the form of the vision, a lamb. And the 144,000 who have his name and the name of his father written on their foreheads. Now again, if you'll look at my notes, 144,000 there. The first line, it's not the bold line, 144,000, but the first line under the underlying heading. These 144,000 were first seen in chapter 7, verses 2 through 9, where they are distinguished from the Gentiles. And I think they are distinguished from the Gentiles also in chapter 14. But turn back quickly to Revelation 7, verse 2. Saw another angel ascending from the rising of the sun, having the seal of the living God. He cried out with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, "Do not harm the earth or the sea or the trees until we have sealed the bondservants of our God on their foreheads." And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel. From the tribe of Judah, 12,000, all the way through 12 tribes. After these things in verse 9, I looked and behold a great multitude which no one could count from every nation and all the tribes and peoples and tongues standing before the throne and before, there's that lamb again, clothed in white robes and palm branches were in their hands. They cried out with a loud voice, saying, "Salvation to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." Now, maybe we'll remember that from all of our discussion back in chapter 7, the interlude chapter. We don't have the devastation, we don't have the desolation wrought until we mark these people. These people are clearly Jews and not Gentiles. They are related to the Lamb, Jesus. So they are Jewish Christians that have a seal on their forehead, a mark on their forehead. The vision, the symbol, the picture that we see is of ownership by the Lamb. He put his mark on them to show his ownership, like he'd brand cattle, I guess, you know. But it is a good thing. You are owned by the Lord. Now, I didn't get into it when we were there in this kind of speculation. I see its appeal. I just don't know how to verify it. You know, people will say, but I still, it may be, people will say, the mark was either on your forehead or on your hand so that it would show your personal allegiance in mind and in action. And I like that. You know, that works. I mean, it's sensible. It's a reasonable kind of a thing. But I don't have anything in Scripture to really back it up either. So lay it on the table there. Maybe that was intended. If so, you know, we're just left with the wondering of it. But the idea, I think, that is important here is it's not a physical mark. I'm not fearing, you know, someday that people are going to go around branding folks with a 666. I don't get that out of this at all. And those who teach that kind of a thing, you know, and really I think it's just absurd. It is a symbolic vision of ownership, and not trying to teach that someday, unless you have a 666 on your brand or on your hand, that you won't be able to buy or sell, you know, or to be pure from allegiance to this beast. But, you know, maybe it is that it represents the mind and your actions. I'm just not sure. But at any rate, we've already seen them. They are different than Gentiles, and they're Christians. So they're Jews who are Christians in 12 tribes are named. Here they are again. They're standing on Mount Zion in chapter 14. And in verse 2, here's a voice from heaven, like many waters, thunder, and harps. So that's a lot of noise. And they sang this song before the throne and the four living creatures and the elders, which takes us back to what two chapters in the book? Where do we read about those guys?
Chapter 5?
Yes, and 4. 4 and 5 is the throne room scene where we've had these four living creatures and these elders. So they're back again. John, when he's caught up into heaven, brethren, sees some wonderful and magnificent things. But they're also clearly all tied together into one thing. And from the beginning, it has been a judgment scene where, with the fifth seal in chapter 6, verses 9, 10, and 11, the souls that have been slain for the testimony of Jesus Christ are under that altar crying out, how long before judgment and vengeance? And they were told only a little while, just as Carol pointed out a moment ago, verses 1 and 3 in the opening of the book say. So we're looking at contemporary things in the first century where they can calculate the number, they can identify the beast and the man, they can relate to all of these things. And true enough, even Paul had problems with the guilds among the Jews, and you had Roman problems as well, that if you didn't pay allegiance to the local gods and to the local unions, if you will, you know, you'd get shut out. You'd lose your business. You couldn't make a living. These kinds of things are being portrayed here, but I don't know, you know, the actual stamp on your forehead is likely. It's just that they know, pinch of salt, who you belong to. So 144,000 been purchased from the earth. And in verse 4, they are the ones who have not been defiled with women. They have kept themselves virgins. They follow the Lamb wherever he goes. So again, they have to be Christians. They've been purchased from among men as the first fruits. So, again, distinguished from the Gentiles, first fruits to God and to the Lamb, and no lie was found in their mouth. They are blameless. Now, in this case, I'm going to take just a moment and run back to an Old Testament passage. So, everybody, 1 Samuel, and it's in your notes, but run on back to 1 Samuel here this evening, and chapter 21. And in 1 Samuel 21, we're going to read the first 6 verses here, where there's an event that takes place that we talked about, as a matter of fact, in our Psalms class. So, 1 Samuel 21, David came to Nob, to Ahimelech the priest, and Ahimelech came trembling to meet David and said to him, why are you alone and no one with you? David said to Ahimelech, the king has commissioned me with a matter and has said to me, let no one know anything about the matter on which I'm sending you and with which I've commissioned you, and I've directed the young men to a certain place. Now therefore, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever can be found. And the priest answered David and said, there is no ordinary bread on hand, but there is consecrated bread. If only the young men have kept themselves from women. And David answered the priest and said to him, surely women have been kept from us, as previously when I set out, and the vessels of the young men were holy. That's their bodies. Though it was an ordinary journey, how much more then today will their vessels be holy? So the priest gave him consecrated bread, for there was no bread there, but the bread of the presence, which was removed from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place when it was taken away. So what's that all about? Well, it's not to teach that women are fundamentally impure and nothing of the kind, of course. But the priests and those who are officiating before God, and in this case, a tremendous exception, which Jesus is going to play off of in the Gospels, and we don't have time to get into that tonight, but this amazing one-time event where some young men who are not priests or involved in the service at all are going to be able to eat of that consecrated bread. If just one thing, what? No sexual relationships. They have to have been free from that. There's a specified time, it's not given here, but it's familiar with them and the priesthood. And so, in other words, not every priest had to be celibate all of his entire life, but when he's serving, he has to stay away. He's showing his devotion to God and no distraction to anyone else. This becomes a symbol of just that. Devotion to God in a, you know, act of worship and service in which I am wholly devoted to Him, free from anything that smacks of the earth, even if that thing itself is holy and pure and right and good and highly encouraged and practiced by all, except when you go to involve this certain activity with God. So, that event, and Jesus using it in the Gospel, is helpful when we get to Revelation chapter 14. So once again, as I look at the vision, I'm not thinking that you have to be a virgin in order to be a Christian. I'm pretty sure you can be married and still be a Christian. Okay? It is a symbol of purity and devotion, and therefore well known to the Jews as well because of 1 Samuel. So, moving on to verse 6, and I saw another angel flying in mid-heaven, having an eternal gospel to what? Okay, does this suggest to you then that this is a final judgment scene after which there will be no earth or any need for this gospel? Well, certainly not. This angel, whatever he's about, has a gospel that is going to continue to be preached to people who live on the earth. So, in every nation and tribe and tongue of people. So whatever this judgment is and these events that we're talking about that are soon to come to pass, here's another reason to believe that they are soon to come to pass and not in some far distant future. This gospel is going to continue to be preached. It's being presented to the Gentiles. But notice the inherent, conflict or distinction between Jews and Gentiles. And yet, they're Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians. We're starting with Christianity, moving into a soon-to-come-to-pass judgment, which, for instance, you can identify and calculate the number of the beast that's going to be involved, and you are going to have Jewish Christians as the first fruits under the symbol of 144,000, limited, as I pointed out in chapter 7, because soon there aren't going to be Jews anymore, and already the gospel is available to everyone on equal terms. So we're dealing somehow with Jewish Christians, Jewish Christians, Jewish Christians, judgment regarding Jewish Christians. Soon to come to pass, calculate the number of the beast. Brethren, if we're not dealing with a judgment that involves Jewish Christians that's soon to come to pass, then whatever we envision these judgments to be, they're probably going to be incorrect. Whether we think they're still coming 2,000 years later, or even if, and a lot of very fine, faithful, knowledgeable, and I mean extremely talented men that I respect most highly, and Jerry among them, it doesn't seem to fit for me that this is a judgment on the Roman Empire either. Rome will endure until 476 A.D. Rome's going to endure for 400 more years. I don't think anywhere in the Bible you're going to find 400 years being described as near, soon, or close, about to take place. I'm thinking it's the judgment on the Jews that would not accept their Messiah that we're involved with here. And the Jewish Christians are the first fruits that come out from those Jews to embrace their Lord. These are the 144,000 in every tribe. So, this gospel will go on being preached after these judgments take place. Now comes verse 9. Third angel follows, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast in his image and receives a mark in his forehead or upon his hand, he also will drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is mixed in full strength in the cup of his anger, and he'll be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. Stay away from the beast. stay away from his image. If you're a Jew, don't serve him, whether you've embraced Christ or not. And if you're a Jewish Christian, don't serve him. And if you're a Gentile, don't serve him. Don't anybody serve Rome. Serve whom? The Lamb. Serve the Lamb. So the third angel is just saying, stay away from the beast. If you don't, then you're going to have trouble in this judgment that is soon to come to pass. Now, brethren, there were Jews who rejected Jesus, caught up in this judgment in 70 A.D. I think they're the prime candidates right here. But, you know, I suspect that we can't read about any of them. There may have been a significant number of Christians, brethren, who should have known better, but did not have the courage or the faith to leave the city when they saw it surrounded by the abomination of desolation. We just don't learn about them anywhere. But I suspect it's true that weaker Christians, perhaps a significant number of people that had embraced Christianity, might still have been tempted to stay in the city and seek their protection, you know, there, rather than leaving like Jesus had said they should in Matthew chapter 24. So, at any rate, we're going to have this judgment. Now, verse 11 brings us, of course, to the passage that makes so many people think of something in our future. I spent quite a bit of time on this with you in preceding classes, and so maybe not so much time tonight. But this smoke of their torment, this fire and this brimstone that this third angel's talking about. Look at verse 11. The smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. They have no rest day and night, those who worship the beast in his image and whoever receives the mark of his name. Here is the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandments of God and their faith in God. Jesus, rather. So, persevere, you saints. Don't worship this beast. Don't bear his mark. Don't be owned by him. If you do, judgment's coming, fire and brimstone, and when it does, the torment, the smoke of the torment, will go up forever and ever, no rest, day and night. And so, it's very tempting, brethren, it's reasonable, I used to think so myself, that, well, it has to be eternal judgment, it has to be some future judgment, it has to be something that hasn't happened yet. Now here again is why I led off the way I did with my begging you, you know, to read the notes. I don't have time, and we've already done this before. But if you will look now with regard to this torment to, I can't even see it now in my notes myself. Where did I put it? Got it. Okay. So Isaiah 34, and I suggest you read 15 verses. So I've got it there in 14, verses 9 through 12. Isaiah 34, the first 15 verses. So I haven't got time for it tonight, but you're going to have essentially the identical same imagery. I mean, word for word. And scattered throughout the text, he says this is a judgment on Edom, which is a historical fact that took place long, long ago. Hundreds of years before Jesus was ever born. This is terminology used extensively in the Old Testament. As I pointed out in our Matthew 24 studies, it does not have to mean by any means eternal or eternity. It means thorough, complete, you can't stop it, there's nothing you can do about it, it's coming for sure, you're going to really catch it. But the expressions do not refer to a literal fire that can burn eternally. If so, we know exactly where Edom is now, wouldn't we? Because in Isaiah 34, he said that was going to start 3,000 years ago. Not that much, but almost. So, you know, it's an expression I'm not having time to get into again tonight as we press on even more difficult things. But you think about that. I think we have falsely concluded that this has to do with Dante's Inferno and a judgment that lies in the future. It hasn't happened even yet. When the Jews would recognize this instantly as something God had frequently said, is the imagery he employs when one nation invades and conquers another. But it all has to do with the perseverance of the saints because they're not worshiping the beast, which clearly is wrong. Now, verse 13. I heard a voice from heaven saying, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Well, brother, that's not hardly a final judgment then, is it? Because people are going to be dying in the Lord. Whatever this torment is, and smoke going up and all of that, which is soon to come to pass and has to do with worshiping Rome, brethren, the gospel's going to go on because we've got the vision of an angel flying into heaven to say so. And now we've got a voice from heaven saying that people are going to be dying from now on. When this judgment is over, then the gospel is still being preached and people are still dying in the Lord. Yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors, for their deeds follow with them. Brethren, this is Philippians chapter 1. And once again, I'm going to race back there and get it for you. In the Philippian letter, chapter 1, isn't this exactly what Paul was saying? Now, Paul would perish after the siege of Jerusalem, or of Israel, the attack had begun, and before the city fell. He was apparently in Rome, killed by Nero in 68. But he said this in Philippians chapter 1, for me to live is Christ, and to die is gain. But if I am to live on in the flesh, this will mean fruitful labor for me, and I do not know which to choose. But I'm hard pressed from both, having the desire to depart and be with Christ, for that is very much better. Yet to remain on in the flesh is more necessary for your sake. So, this, you know, potentially opens up a whole other can of worms, and we'll deal with this, you know, in some other venue. But, brethren, what do you think happens to you when you die? Paul thought he would depart and be with the Lord, and I think he was right. Okay? Now, we've got some things that we'll have to wrestle with, you know, that immediately leap to mind. This isn't the place for those. But I think that's what, you know, is being talked about in Revelation and talked about here. So whether or not there is, I won't even say that. We'll talk about it later. Okay? But when you die, you depart to be with the Lord. In some sense, somehow, as what Paul was expecting, that's what these people are expecting, and they're blessed for it. Then you have verse 14. Now we're really going to get into it. It'll help us to identify this judgment. I looked. Behold, a white cloud, sitting on the cloud, one like a son of man, having a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. And another angel, that'd be number 4, came out of the temple, crying out with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, put in your sickle and reap, because the hour to reap has come, because the harvest of the earth is ripe. Oh my goodness. I'm so unhappy with myself. Because, and I knew I had missed this. Because, you remember Charlie and the Chocolate Factory? The good one, the first one. You know, and I think I've had to do this with you before already, where he says, stop, you know, erase that. Remember, I forgot something really big back at verse 8, and I really didn't intend to. I just got caught up in what I was doing, totally forgot. Really important, and not in your notes. So get your pencil out. I want you to pencil this in on your notes at 14:8 with the second angel. Just pardon me, I just total lapse of presence and missed what I was doing here. So here's a list I want you to get into your notes and also into your Bible, but you know, get it in both places. In verse 8, the second angel says, fallen, fallen is what? Yes. Babylon the Great's first appearance in Revelation is right there. That is the first time Babylon is named. It is named Babylon the Great. Take note of the greats. When you have a great city, it just might be Babylon. Babylon the Great. She has made all the nations drink of the wine of the passion of her fornication. Now, brethren, really, there are only two reasonable possibilities for this city. Only two. It is Jerusalem. Or It is wrong. And really, brethren, those are the only two you can argue. So whatever anybody else is saying about the Antichrist and China and Rome and, Vatican Rome and all that other stuff that people come up with, it's just none of that. There's only two reasonable possibilities. It could be old first century Rome, or it could be Jerusalem. So get, to studying and thinking about every occurrence of Babylon in the book and all the clues with this list. The other references to Babylon in the book of Revelation are chapter 16 and verse 19. Write it down. 16:19 says, "And the great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. And Babylon the Great was remembered before God to give her the cup of the wine of his fierce wrath." Sounds like grapes of wrath, doesn't it? Then in 17:5, "Upon her forehead," remember the great harlot, riding this same beast that we just saw in chapter 13, "a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great." Third time the term has been used. "The mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth." However, I would quickly add verse 6 there, since in 17:6 it says, "And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus." Babylon the Great is the city that's the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth, fornicator back here in chapter 14, and she's drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of the witnesses, which in the book of Acts is only the apostles. That's something to think about. Who's guilty of the blood of the apostles? What city would that be? Soon to come to pass. Okay? The next one is in chapter 18 and verse 2. "He cried out with a mighty voice saying, Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great." Well, it's the same thing this angel's doing in chapter 14:8. "She's become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. And all the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her fornication." It's the way she was identified in chapter 14. "The kings of the earth had committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth had become rich by the wealth of her sensuality." He goes on to say, "Her sins have piled up as high as heaven. God's remembered her iniquity and pay her back even as she is paid." So that city's going down. The next occurrence is in chapter 18 and verse 10. "Standing at a distance because of the fear of her torment, we have these people saying, Woe, woe, the great city, Babylon, the strong city, for in 1 hour your judgment, has come." And its last occurrence, the actual word Babylon, is again in chapter 18, third time, now verse 21. "And a strong angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, Thus will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and will not be any longer." Okay? Babylon is identified as the great city every single time. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 times in the book of Revelation. I will maintain, and I think demonstrate, very convincingly later, that the only conceivable great city in biblical terminology is and has always been Jerusalem and not Rome, but that in due time. At any rate, very important in chapter 14 and verse 8 that you get the list of scriptures down. You're able to go find Babylon, get all of the identifying marks about her. That is the city that the judgment is coming on in the book of Revelation, which begins and ends by telling you that these events are shortly to come to pass. Rome doesn't go down for 400 more years. I'm very sure this is Jerusalem, not Rome. And we'll deal more specifically with these various identifiers, especially this fornication and whatnot, in chapters 17 and 18. If you want to read ahead, go to 17 and 18, where I'll show you a chart when we get there. Each of the identifying marks there will fit Jerusalem perfectly, some will also fit Rome, and some cannot possibly fit Rome. So we'll deal with that when we get to 17 and 18, where Babylon figures more prominently, but here, you know, mentioned in 14:8. Okay, now, then, that second angel, third angel's in verse 9, don't worship the beast, okay, going to be torment if you do. 14, we have one like a son of man, golden crown, sharp sickle. Well, that's going to be Jesus. And another angel came out of the temple, crying with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud with the crown, put in your sickle and reap, because the hour to reap has come, because the harvest of the earth is ripe. Question. In verses 15 and 16, when he who sits on the cloud with the golden crown reaps, sat on the cloud, swung his sickle over the earth, and the earth was reaped. Is that a good thing or a bad thing, and do you want to be harvested like that or not? Don't answer. You'd probably be wrong. I'm thinking it's a real good thing, and you want to be a part of the first fruits. And I think you'll notice that when you go to read carefully, that harvest is very distinct from the next harvest. And the next harvest goes into the grapes, is the grapes of wrath, and goes into the press, but not the first one. I don't think they're the same. I don't think they end up the same. I don't think they're going to the same place. And they're distinguished from each other. There's a first reaping, and then there's a different reaping. There's a reaping by who I take to be the Lord, and then there's one that's not. Now in 17, another angel came out of the temple. So that's 5 now, which is in heaven. He had a sharp sickle. And another angel, that's 6, the one who has power over fire, came out from the altar, and he called with a loud voice to him that had the sharp sickle, saying, put in your sharp sickle, see, it's a second and different harvest, and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, because her grapes are ripe. The angel swung his sickle to the earth, gathered the clusters of the vine of the earth, threw them into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood came out from the winepress up to the horses' bridles for a distance of 200 miles. Now, once again, brethren, I know it's hard, and it frustrates me too. Sometimes you'll see a symbol, and it just seems really easy to equate with a physical event that took place in first century Israel. And I think it should be, because we have evidence that helps us to do that. Other times you see a symbol, and I think, well, in this case, I really don't think that I'm going to be able to find a literal physical, you know, corollary. Because it looks to me like the symbol itself is trying to portray an idea by the use of physical imagery, but it's not intending to say that it'll come physically. In other words, my mom raised horses, my dad as well, as you know, for a long time, and a horse's bridle is about yay high. Call it 4 feet, maybe a little more. Depends on how tall your horse is. 200 miles of blood, 4 feet deep, brethren. That's a lot of blood. And if it's human blood, and people have run calculations and all the rest of that, and I don't know how wide it is, you know, but if you got 200 miles, 4 feet deep, that's a lot of people, and I'm not sure that, you know, it'd be more than all of Israel, maybe, but, you know, I don't know, but what, it's more than all of Europe. I haven't calculated myself, but that's just a lot. 4 feet deep blood, okay? And then I look at it, so I think, well, you know, surely, physically, that's never happened. Don't expect it ever will, because, you know, I don't see any judgment passages in the Bible that suggest that that's how God's going to judge us in the end either. But it's curious to me that it's all about blood, that it's just massive, you know, ocean or river of blood. That's the exact same length as Israel was in the first century and is to this day, 200 miles long. So, well, Larry, you know, you're so wishy-washy. You say the blood's not 4 feet deep, but it is 200 miles long. And, well, no, I'm not saying that the blood is there at all. What I'm saying is that it looks like an image of complete death and devastation on Israel, which happens to be 200 miles long. It's because it's everything in the rest of the book points to a first century fulfillment soon to come to pass on the people who are responsible for the blood of the saints that we're the first fruits among the Jews. What other judgment is that? It's got to be the fall of Jerusalem, the one that both the Old and New Testaments talk about. So to wrap it up, it's judgment on Israel is my take. 18. There it is. Look at my notes. I knew there was one more thing I wanted to hit on in this last minute. Look at my notes on chapter 14, verses 14 through 16, and then 17 through 20. I think the first harvest is a good thing. These are the people that became faithful Christians, and they would have gotten out of Jerusalem in accordance with Jesus' teaching. These people are harvested, and it's a good thing. The Lord's going to keep them. They leave the town. The others who stay, they're the unfaithful Jews who go into this wine press. Now, but I wanted to talk about this outside the city thing. It could mean that the city being unclean, or that's what this references, or that Rome is an outside force that's casting all the rocks and missiles and what into the city, which very like, the city becoming a wine press with all this blood in it and all that. But about this blood up to the horse's bridles, let me read that, bell's rung, and we'll be done. The bloodshed throughout Palestine in the 3.5 years of the war, everywhere in Israel, is mentioned frequently by Josephus, who was an eyewitness. Here are some quotes. A stream of blood flowed down the temple steps, and the bodies of those slain at the top slipped to the bottom. The blood seemed more abundant than the flames. They choked the alleys with corpses and deluged the entire city with gore, so that many fires were quenched by the blood of the slain. It's a tough book reading Wars of the Jews. It's must read before you die. but it is tough going. So what I'm thinking I'm seeing is just that. It's a symbolic of the complete overthrow and the death of those who rejected their Messiah. They wouldn't accept this eternal gospel. And it's taking place in Israel, which was 200 miles, from top to bottom. Okay. My phone's talking to me in there. I have to do something about that. I bought a smartphone that is so smart that without me asking it to do it, it reads my voice, types the words into the internet search engine, and tells me that it's looking for an answer to my query. And that's what it's doing right now. So it's hunting up something in the book of Revelation about blood up to the horse's bridle and telling me about it. Okay. So, worst of it all is, I turn the volume off faithfully, but they've decided in my smartphone that that should override everything. So even though my volume is off, it talks to me. I can't stand it. All right. No time for comment or question. Never is in one of my classes as well. My apologies.